You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we continue with our little tome on weather control. And I am continuing to read from Chapter 5, a book entitled Toward the Year 2018. Chapter 5 was written by Thomas F. Malone. And Thomas F. Malone was the chairman of the Committee on Atmospheric Sciences of the National Academy of Sciences and vice president and director of research of the Travelers Insurance Company. This book was published back in the 60s. How man will control the weather. At the risk of oversimplification, and with the usual caveats about fallibility, the present position and some judgmental evaluations of the future prospects for weather modification can be summarized as follows. Number one, field results have demonstrated unequivocally that several cubic miles of supercooled clouds, liquid cloud droplets at temperatures below freezing, can be transformed into ice crystal clouds by seeding with appropriate chemicals. The technology for performing this kind of weather modification will be perfected rapidly over the next decade. Number two, dissipation of supercooled fog over an airfield runway is now operationally feasible and has been used to good economic advantage by airlines in the United States and in other nations. Further improvement in technique will likely affect only the economics, not the efficacy of this control measure. Number three, recent experimentation in clearing certain types of warm fog, that is, droplets at temperatures above freezing, over airports is beginning to provide encouraging results. An important breakthrough in this type, highly localized weather control, is likely to be realized in a matter of years. Number four, relatively little serious attention has been given to conscious interference of the processes at the interface between the atmosphere and underlying surface beyond demonstrating that it is possible to inhibit evaporation from water surfaces and vegetation. If, as it now appears to be likely, these interface processes turn out to be important to large-scale modification of the climate, there is a high probability that the techno-something could go through explosive development in the period from 1975 to 1995. Number five, persuasive, although by no means conclusive evidence, suggest that rainfall can be increased through cloud seeding by from 5 to 20%, say 10%, depending on the conditions. There's a high probability that residual ambiguity will be resolved by 1975, and a further high probability that by 1980, naturally occurring rainfall can be either augmented or diminished locally by proved techniques. The probability is high that by 1990, rainfall several hundred miles downwind from the site of the operations can be increased or decreased at will. Number six, there are indications that Soviet scientists have succeeded in reducing hail damage by a factor of from 3 to 5 by introducing silver iodide directly into susceptible parts of hail-producing clouds. This form of weather modification will probably always remain local, but will develop rapidly over the next decade, and there is a high probability that it will begin to be adopted for widespread use by the early 1980s. Number seven, physically reasonable approaches to the suppression of lightning have been tried You'll have to excuse me, folks. I'm reading with not a very clear copy. Let me start this paragraph over. Number 7. Physically reasonable approaches to the suppression of lightning have been tried with what appears, on balance, to be promising results. Progress on this highly localized modification measure will be retarded pending a satisfactory explanation for the lightning discharge produced, but the probabilities are high that operational techniques will be available by the late 1980s. Number 8. Cloud seeding techniques that are of sufficient merit to warn field experimentation have been advanced for the modification of hurricanes. The limited tests have not as yet yielded even preliminary conclusions. This approach should be pursued vigorously, but the probability of success is not high, only about 50%. New concepts are needed, and they are likely to emerge from computer simulation of hurricanes for 5 years are allowed for the development of an adequate mathematical model. 5 more years for assessing the consequences of intervention of various kinds, and then 10 years of field experimentation for validation. It seems unreasonable to expect much before 1990, with the probabilities fair to good that a proved technology will exist by the year 2000. Now, I have to interject something here, folks. If you've been listening carefully, you'll see that all the predictions were for the completion of this technology and for the ability to perfect weather control in the 80s and at the latest by 1990. Now, I want you to ask yourself, when did all the strange weather patterns begin? When did the crazy storms start to come? When did hundreds and hundreds of tornadoes hit the Midwest out of all reasonable expectations? When did the flooding and the unbelievable droughts and the fires take place? All after 1990. Number 9. No technique for consciously influencing large-scale weather patterns yet exists, and not much progress can be expected for another decade until the scientific results of the recently approved Global Atmospheric Research Program begin to be available. The 1970s should be a productive and exciting decade for basic research on the general circulation of the atmosphere. The 1980s and 1990s should be an equally productive period of experimentation by means of computer simulation on the technology of large-scale climate modification. The probability of success in broad climate modification is likely to exceed 50% by the year 2018. Now, remember, a lot of this success was based upon the perfection of some kind of computer models. Computers, folks, became successful and exceeded what was expected of them by quite an exponential figure. And so I don't know how this could have increased or moved up their date for completion of all of these things, but I can say that he has put an awful lot of emphasis on the success of these programs based upon the success of developing proper computer models. Number 10. A distinct probability should be recognized that large-scale climate modification will be effected inadvertently before the power of conscious modification is achieved. Calculations with the relatively crude large-scale atmospheric models at hand suggest that the from 10 to 15% increase in the minute amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since 1900 has caused surface temperatures to rise 0.2% centigrade, while temperatures in the stratosphere may have decreased 10 times as much. It should be possible by 1980 to predict with precision the effects on the atmosphere in the year 2018 of the likely rate at which carboniferous fuel is being consumed. There is a small probability that these effects will not be tolerable. Air pollution may have already extended its influence beyond the urban domain. Contamination of the upper atmosphere by rocket exhaust is a problem that may be of practical importance sooner than we realize. Finally, agricultural cultivation and urbanization are transforming the nature of the surface underlying the atmosphere on a large-scale basis, with possibly important consequences that we should be able to assess during the 1980s. For purposes of assessing the international implication of weather modification, it is useful to divide modification activities into four classes. 1. Local intervention that produces only local results. For example, fog dissipation, lightning and hail suppression, and certain kinds of rain augmentation or diminution or lessening. 2, local intervention that may produce significant changes tens or hundreds of miles downstream. For example, certain kinds of rainfall modification are tampering with hurricanes. 3, intervention over a large area are concerted operations at several points aiming at restructuring climatic regimes. For example, interference with exchange processes at the interface between the atmosphere and the underlying surface. And 4, the inadvertent intervention that has slow response, long-term effects on the global climate. For example, alterations in atmospheric structure resulting from an increase in carbon dioxide as a consequence of combustion processes or contamination of the upper atmosphere by rocket exhaust. The first class of weather modification activity poses few, if any, international problems. The second class presents issues involving conventional concepts of national sovereignty, supported by existing international law. These include, for example, the right to maintain national territory, including airspace, free of physical interference on the part of other nations, the right to control the acts of individuals on national territory, the right to protect the lives, property, and interests of nationals from the acts of others, and finally, the right to indemnification when the action of one nation or its nationals infringes on another nation or its nationals. There is no reason to believe that these issues require more than conventional international mechanisms for resolution. It is quite possible, however, that an appropriate mechanism would have to be established or an existing one adapted for the purpose. The availability of a responsive and effective international organization, read United Nations, is essential for the peaceful solution of any conflict of national interests that might arise. The third and the fourth classes of weather modification activity share in common the characteristic that each is concerned with the global environmental consequences of human activity. In one case, the global consequences follow directly from the human activity. In the other, they follow indirectly. With regard to deliberate intervention, one or more mechanisms or international agencies are needed to decide on behalf of the world community what can and should be done to implement these decisions and to regulate national activities in such a way as to minimize international conflict. Now, with regard to inadvertent intervention, a mechanism is needed to determine the global consequences of contemporary human activities and to see that these consequences do not cross the threshold of intolerability from the view of mankind as a whole. Possibly, this international body could be given policing powers and perhaps the authority to implement countervailing measures when human activities affect the global environment deleteriously. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have a few comments before I go on here. I know that some of you may know this, some of you do not. But at one point, I was the head of the Mixed Gas Deep Saturation Diving Department of the College of Oceaneering in Wilmington, California. Now, when I taught diving, the state of the art, ladies and gentlemen, was pretty well established. We had actually had men in the water without armored dress outside of Bell's, well below 1,600 feet, which not too many years before that was considered to be absolutely impossible, out of the question. We also had, with the company that I worked for, an armored diving dress that was capable of putting a man on the ocean floor at 2,500 feet. And in fact, a woman, Dr. Sylvia Earle, proved that it didn't take a professional diver to go to 2,500 feet in the armored diving dress that we perfected because we suited her up and she did it. She is a well-known marine biologist. Now, when I was teaching at the College of Oceaneering, which, by the way, at that time was the world premier commercial diving institution, and most of the divers in the industry, and I'm talking about the offshore oil well industry, the salvage industry, and many other ocean industries, came from that school. We taught surface air diving. We taught mixed gas diving. We taught deep saturation diving. We taught bell diving. We taught we taught everything, the state of the art that prevailed at that particular time. We used air, we used helium and oxygen, we used tri-mixes to eliminate some of the effects of the helium tremors during deep dives where the divers were actually living under a lot of pressure for a lot of days. And one of the things that we had to do, folks, is to make sure that the gases that we were using were pure and that the mixtures that we were using were correct mixtures, or we could kill people very easily. And this even pertained to air. And at some point in the decompression process, the mixed gas or the tri-mixes were vented from the chamber and replaced with air, while the divers usually went on oxygen. And this exchange had to take place at a certain point, and then they would come off of oxygen and then breathe the regular air mixture in order to acclimate their system so that when they stepped out of the chamber, they would be alive and healthy and everything would be okay. And we had to know the exact oxygen percentage in the air. I'm talking about the air that you breathe. We had to know the exact percentage of the carbon dioxide in the air. We had to know the exact percentage of nitrogen in the air, because all of these things have a detrimental effect upon a diver if we don't know, or if these percentages are not in their proper proportions. Because the rate of gas absorption, or the rate of gas elimination from the human body, depends upon the partial pressure of each of the gases in the mixture. And so it is absolutely essential to know the percentages of the gases in the mix or in the air to be able to calculate the partial pressure of that gas upon the system of the diver. And I'm going to tell you right now, at no point ever did the percentage of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at that school in the harbor in Wilmington, California, which is one of the busiest harbors in the world, ever exceed the normal level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since man has been measuring the percentage of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I don't know where they get all of these figures, but I can tell you right now, professional divers know exactly what the percentages are every single day that they make a dive, especially when a chamber decompression or a surface decompression or a long, drawn-out decompression from a tremendous deep saturation dive is involved. And as far as I know, even to this day, in my conversations with my friends and those that I taught how to dive over the years, not one single incident of any measurement of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere above the normal expected percentage levels has ever been measured by any diving team on this earth at any place at any time. And now that we've got that little lecture out of the way, let me continue. You see, you have to understand that a lot of these things we're being bombarded with is just nothing but unadulterated bullshit because nobody ever questions it. And if nobody ever questions it, they can be led by this. They can be manipulated by it. They can be scared by it. And the answer is always an international organization. Well, let me continue. It is probably unrealistic and might even be undesirable at this instant in history to create immediately the international instruments necessary to fulfill all these conceivable functions. However, in the spirit of von Neumann's admonition that a long sequence of small correct decisions will be required, I venture to suggest a discrete step that seems to me to be warranted in view of the imminence of the year 2018. Now, remember, he wrote this, and it was published back in the 60s, and he's talking about the imminence of the year 2018, as if that year has some special significance. And if it does, it's beyond my comprehension, because I've never even heard that year mentioned before, except in this chapter of this book. And he's talking about the imminence of the year 2018, like it's going to be tomorrow. He continues, any action that is contemplated should satisfy these criteria. 1. It should be a modest step and should avoid sensationalism. 2. It should seek to fill in the gaps in our knowledge and lay as solid a foundation of fact as is possible for any future decisions that may need to be made. And 3. It should be international, interdisciplinary, and as non-political as possible. These criteria would appear to be met by assembling under the auspices of the International Council of Scientific Unions, ICSU, a small, permanent, full-time working group charged with the responsibility of exploring in depth the scientific and other aspects of the problem and reporting its findings and recommendations back to the world community through ICSU from time to time. The highest standard of intellectual excellence should be established for participation, and membership on the working group should be drawn from nominations by the national organizations represented in ICSU. Membership should include physical scientists with experience in the atmospheric sciences, oceanography, natural resource analysis, physics, mathematics, and chemistry. It should also involve life scientists with a special interest in ecosystems, social scientists with a special interest in economics and international relations, and legal scholars with a particular interest in international law. The hardcore of a dozen or so senior members should be supported by a number of research associates and provided with the advanced computational facilities for sophisticated simulation studies. Is a cloud hanging over your little abode? Do you look around and wonder how you're going to weather the storm that's coming? Have you ever really seen the rain? Do you understand that an economic flood could wash away everything that you've accumulated and worked for all your life? Well, if you do, and if you really care about yourself and about those who you say you love, and we know that some of you really do, We also know that some of you pretend to. Then you will establish your own methods of weather control and call our sponsor Swiss America Trading. Get your hands on something to seed your clouds with for a little lightning abatement. And to stave away the torrential downpour that is likely to wash your family into a ditch. Wow, sometimes I amaze myself. I don't know where this came from. I didn't sit down and think it up, and I certainly didn't write it out before I started doing this. I just did it. And I'm a little surprised by it because it fits perfectly. Call Swiss America Trading 1-800-289-2646. Folks, it is extremely important not that you make great investments in precious metals, but that you protect what you have. If you have enough money and you have enough guts and you want to take a little risk, go ahead and invest whatever you want. But at least protect what you have, or at least a portion of what you have, with the only commodity in the history of the world that maintains its value no matter what. You see, when you look at the price of gold and you see the price of gold or silver, you see the price of gold or silver go down, all it means is that the confidence in the dollar has gone up and the dollar has more purchasing power. If you see the price in gold and silver go up, it means confidence in the dollar, or the phony paper that you're using, is not really a dollar. In fact, around here we call them frauds. It simply means that confidence in the frauds has dropped or declined. That you're in an inflationary period and it won't buy as much. If people ever catch on to the truth, it won't buy anything, folks. Now, of silver in particular, and of gold, are disappearing. Silver is becoming scarce. It's because somebody is buying silver up in large quantities, and when that's gone, they'll turn to gold. We know who it is. It's our job to keep an eye on the people in the world who are movers and shakers, who make the policy and make the decisions that nations follow. And these are the people who are doing these things today. It tells us that our predictions of an economic crisis are right on the mark. And it also tells us that we're getting closer and closer to the reality. I'm not here to make Swiss America Trading rich. And Swiss America Trading doesn't sponsor this broadcast to get rich. In fact, it's caused them to lose an awful lot of their business. It's caused them to be attacked by our enemies. Swiss America sponsors this broadcast because they believe in the message, and I accepted them as our sponsor simply because they can offer you a great service, and they do it honestly. They guarantee what they do. They give you a buyback policy, and I guarantee what they do. And if it isn't done, all you have to do is let me know, and I will burn some ears off. And if I have to, I will drive down to Phoenix. And I will sit on somebody's desk until it's taken care of. So, you can't get a better deal. Call Swiss America Trading. And get your affairs in order. And do it right now. 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. I bet you think that's a recording. But folks, right outside my window, it is storming. It was a beautiful day yesterday, and last night we did the first broadcast on weather control. Today was a beautiful day. Up until just before we left the center to come home, and the sky almost instantly grew dark and overcast with the type of storm clouds that you don't really want to see. And lightning is striking all around us, and the rain is falling. And so, you get your taste of it right along with us. I continue with Chapter 5 from Toward the Year 2018. Adequate and stable support should be assured for at least 10 years by voluntary rational contributions or through an agency such as UNESCO that sponsors general international scientific work. Appropriate liaison should be maintained with the joint organizing committee that ICSU has established in cooperation with the World Meteorological Organization to provide guidance to the Global Atmospheric Research Program, which is concerned with the scientific problems of the general circulation of the global atmosphere and with the development of physical methods for long-range forecasting. And just so you won't wonder anymore, and it's not a trivia question, it was a recording, folks. But the storm that I described to you is taking place outside this house. It should be clearly recognized that the objectives of the proposed ICSU working group, with its emphasis on determining the technological feasibility of weather and climate modification and some of the implications involved, differ in several major respects from the activities of the Joint Organizing Committee. The highly successful efforts of the ICSU Committee on Atmospheric Sciences, which under the aegis of the International Union of Geodesy and Geophysics, the IUGG, led to international unanimity on the Global Atmospheric Research Program, suggest that a proved pattern of international cooperation has been laid. Activities such as the International Geophysical Year, the International Year of the Quiet Sun, and the International Biological Program support the point of view that international non-governmental organizations such as ICSU and IUGG can play important roles in this undertaking. I do not presume to believe that the step I have suggested, if taken, is sufficient by itself, but it is a positive action with important consequences that cannot be foreseen in detail at this time. We're going to have to look into that International Year of the Quiet Sun. That's a new one. U.S. goals encompass cooperation on weather. Even a cursory examination of international cooperative projects leads to the conclusion that in the present-day world, the survival and effectiveness of any particular activity are in direct proportion to the degree that the activity supports national interests. It is desirable, therefore, to test the program I have here proposed in the light of this fact. In the international field, the United States national objective and the basic elements of our foreign policy in support of this objective were spelled out a few years ago with remarkable clarity by Secretary of State Dean Rusk. The national objective, he declared, is a peaceful world of independent nations, each free to choose its own institutions, so long as it does not threaten the freedom of others, and all free to cooperate in their common interests and in the welfare of mankind. The basic elements of foreign policy, then, are fivefold. 1. To build the strength of the free world and to protect it against aggression. 2. To enlarge and improve our partnership with the other economically advanced nations of the free world. 3. To assist the less developed nations in advancing economically, socially, and politically. 4. To improve and strengthen the organizations and institutions that enable the nations of the world to work together more effectively. And 5. To seek earnestly and untiringly areas of common interest with our adversaries. Not a great deal of imagination is required to envision the manner in which each of these elements could be supported by a carefully considered program to prepare for what may turn out to be, over the next 50 years, one of the major confrontations between public policy and new technological capabilities. If this support moves us one step forward to the national objective stated above, the interests of all mankind will have been well served. And that's the end of that chapter, folks. Now, I really don't know what you think about all this, but I have to tell you that it is a subject that many people have attempted to penetrate over the years. And some make claims that they know all about this stuff, and some come off the wall with these really weird explanations and scientific theories, and the Russian woodpecker radar is changing our weather, and that's the biggest crock of crap I ever heard in my life. The Russian woodpecker radar had nothing to do with our weather. It had to do with detecting aircraft and missiles and anything in the air at long distances. It had nothing to do with the weather. But we do know that there was a tremendous thrust to attempt to develop means to control the weather and manipulate the weather. And my father was involved in some of the early experiments of this kind. And at a point in the late 50s and then in the early 60s, a curtain was drawn across all of this research. And scientists and institutions who had committed years and years of research and millions of dollars to this effort all of a sudden would not talk about what they were doing or their results in this area, or whether they had been successful in any way. They stopped publishing papers on the subject. And no one would make any kind of a commitment to whether or not this research was still continuing, or whether it had been terminated, or what. We have had snatches of glimpses behind the curtain from time to time that tell us that this research and this experimentation has been ongoing throughout all the years and has never stopped, not even for a little while. It has been well funded. Some of the best minds in the country and in the institutions around the nation have been concentrating on this research. And we also know that if this emphasis has been placed upon weather control in the United States, that there are probably, we cannot say with certainty, but with a high degree of probability, the same type of research and the same type of emphasis and the same type of funding has been going on in other nations all around the world, most importantly the Soviet Union, or what used to be the Soviet Union. And if you read Mikhail Gorbachev's book entitled Perestroika, you know that that whole collapse thing was just a decoy, just a method of lulling the West to sleep and promoting the disarmament of the armies and navies and air forces of the world and the peoples of the different nations in order to bring about the goal of all of the works of these people, which is a one-world totalitarian socialist government under the aegis of the United Nations. Wouldn't weather control be a convenient weapon to wield in the pursuit of that goal? Wouldn't it also help to neutralize millions of people around the world who believe in prophecy to be able to manipulate the weather to make them believe that God is bringing to fruition the prophecies in the book of Revelations. What a wonderful tool that would be. And even if it were discovered that it was really being wielded by nations, by scientists, by military generals in order to bring all of this about, whether in the Soviet Union or the United States or Canada or French Guinea, doesn't make any difference. It would be used by the internationalists and the globalists as an excuse why we must have an international governing body to prevent nation states from using weapons of this kind, just like they used the existence of the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb and the ozone holes and the burning of the rainforest to cite the same need for this international governing body to control all of these people. Well, let me tell you, folks, if their own governments and their own people can't control them, what makes you think a bunch of rube idiot jerks in the United Nations building in New York City is going to be able to control them? And every attempt to exert military pressure through UN peacekeeping forces has been the most laughable episode since the Keystone Cops. It's never going to work because nobody's committed to the United Nations flag. Nobody gets that chill that runs up your spine and the hair on the back of your neck stands up like you get when Old Glory marches by. No one really knows what the UN really stands for, what it's all about. So how can anybody be ideologically committed to it, other than some vague promise of a utopian world of peace where nobody's going to get mugged anymore? Have you ever noticed how the UN delegates shy away from certain areas of New York City? They don't even believe their own bullshit. And that's the truth. So, we don't know the state of the art of weather control. We don't know exactly how it's done. We have seen some glimpses that gives us some clues. But nobody really knows. And unless there's some monumental revelation, I don't think anybody's gonna really know too soon. And you can go to lectures presented by anybody you want to, claims that they know all this stuff. I'm gonna tell you right now, there are no leaks. All leaks of an intelligence nature are intentional to make people or nations behave in a certain manner, which is desirable to those who caused the so-called leak. So be very careful when you deal with all of this stuff. And understand that we're dealing with a fraternity of liars, deceivers, and manipulators who want control of everything. And if we're not careful, we will get it. We will get to be controlled by them. And I, for one, don't want to. Let me tell you how people have responded to this. I've had all kinds of calls today and faxes. I'm going to read you one right now. Weather control, dear Bill. Review, and listen to this, folks, and go out and look this up. Review what Zbigniew Brzezinski had to say on the subject in his book, Between Two Ages, on pages 56 and 57. The same can be read with additional information in The Unseen Hand by A. Ralph Epperson on page 345. I was an air traffic controller with the Air Force and Federal Aviation Administration for 30 years and was involved in making official weather observations at some of the airports where I was stationed. My last facility was a TRACON that had ASR-8 radar. This radar had the usual linear and circular polarization that most radar has. The circular polarization is used to penetrate weather cells, heavy precipitation, etc. The linear polarization is the most used because it provides the best return under most conditions. The ASR-8 radar has weather return enhancing abilities also. For instance, one can outline the weather cell and omit the core. Define the core, strengthen or weaken the weather return, or eliminate it completely. Some conditions cannot be completely eliminated. These are but a few of the radar's abilities. What I am driving at is this. During the 12 or so years of using and controlling this radar, I personally observed some very unexplainable weather phenomena right here in Southern California. I have watched the very large active weather cells, 40 to 50 miles across, virtually stop at the shoreline and turn into a fine mist and eventually dissipate. Other times the radar revealed things that even the technicians were at a loss to explain. I have been watching and aware of strange weather conditions since the early 70s to 76, and 76 was a very strange year. Keep up the good work, signed Dick. Had another call from a gentleman who said that he participated in large-scale experimentation on manipulation of the weather using what he called scalar wave technology. He said that he had attended several lectures given by Colonel Tom Bearden, and that Tom Bearden was very close to the truth, but was not as yet right on the money. And his attribution of the development of weather control to the Soviet Union was way off the mark. And I would tend to agree with that statement because in my research, ladies and gentlemen, I have discovered, and the Russians have admitted, that they never had anything that we didn't give them. And let me remind you, lest you forget, whatever your perception of the state of the art of any technology that you can see, feel, or put your hands on, or even have the slightest knowledge about, in secret, in these black projects, where they have unlimited amounts of money to play with, they are from 50 to 100 years ahead. A Navy pilot once told me, "Bill, out in the desert, we have things that fly in the air that are so beyond the capability of the average man's understanding that they resemble nothing less than sheer magic, and they belong to us." Now, if that doesn't make you stop and pause and think, ladies and gentlemen, it's beyond my understanding of what will. We have some marvelous things that we play with in our homes. There are some marvelous things on the market. There are wonderful machines and electronic gadgets that corporations play with, and that are used in the manufacturing of other things, and that we fly on between cities. And all of these things, not so long ago, were beyond the capability of anyone's understanding. And I can remember as a child reading the books of Jules Verne and understanding the century and the time that he lived in, and wondering if this man didn't have some crystalline structure that he could hold in his hand and look into the future. And even more interesting and intriguing thought. Is this. What if somebody now, or at some future date, has actually perfected an understanding of what time really is? What if they have perfected a method of traveling in time? What if time travel is not some science fiction fantasy? What if the angels who walked in to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and warned Lot and his wife to leave the city were somebody from 1992? And with that thought, ladies and gentlemen, I leave you to your dreams. Good night, and God bless you all.